You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
I'm going to select one tiny little piece of a great matrix, a deceptive matrix that we've been living in, probably since about 1910 or 1920, when this matrix was invented by the geniuses of the KGB in Russia. That tiny little piece will be a reflection today on a movie by Steven Spielberg, a very great movie as far as it's accomplished in artistic construction. The title of the movie is Bridge of Spies. Bridge of Spies. A movie about real historical event, but it distorts those events, and almost no one notices among the great movie reviewers. And it distorts them in a way that is anti-American and anti-Christian and anti-truth. And I'm going to touch on the general reaction, which was so positive and so annoyingly positive from virtually every great media outlet. That is, from the movie reviewer of every major outlet, Variety, New York Times, etc. Then I'm going to share with you the entire movie review from Chronicles Magazine by George McCartney. McCartney is at least an educated reviewer. He's a man who obviously is aware of the history of his own time and of his parents' time, the 20th century, and what the occurrences during that century were, how we arrived at this point where we are lost in the woods. If men like McCartney know the way back, most people don't. I personally want to reflect on his review because it reveals great truths that most of these other reviewers apparently are totally unaware of. It's worth reflecting on every word of McCartney's review because he reveals the truth about the furniture of these other reviewers' minds, the cast-off mistaken furniture upon which they live their daily lives, assuming the validity of many things that are invalid. McCarthy goes over the facts of the real history of that period that these other reviewers from the Washington Post, the New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, seem so unaware of. If you ignore history, you're doomed to repeat it. You can't ignore the past. It's not even past. Perhaps the real history of the events in the movie, Bridge of Spies, will seem to be trivial to someone living today. How does that affect us? It affects everything about our lives, because way back in the woods there was a fork we took, and the only way to cure our state of being lost in the woods is to go back to that fork and take the right path. You've heard of do-overs? This is a time, well, it's a time for doing over a lot of the thought processes of the last century, a lot of what we imbibed and became part of, never realizing that we were in a matrix, that we were deceived. Sadly, that we were useful idiots. And the political gospels we preached were mistaken at their foundation. How can you correct it without going back to the foundation, to going back to the original error? I'm going to state this with candor, and it's an uncomfortable candor for me. But Tom Hanks, the Coen brothers, Steven Spielberg, DreamWorks, is deceiving us. Now, I prefer to think that they're unaware that they're deceiving us. They themselves have been deceived. That they're useful idiots. That they're Stalin's useful idiots. But their politically correct version of events that occurred in the movie Bridge of Spies does great damage by disrespecting the brave opponents of the communist infiltration into our arts and media, academia, and industry that occurred in the 20th century. These foundational untruths, these wrongful impressions of what lays underneath our culture and our lives, our every moment, our consciousness, the drama, the novels, the music that we take into ourselves and weave into our concepts of what the world is about. These distortions of our own past, they cause the decline the decay, and the dismemberment of our culture, which has produced what has been called the suicide of the West. We're in a culture that has fallen out of love with the very things that hold it together. Every historian, cultural commentator like Joe Campbell and other people have pointed out that this is cultural suicide. We have to have a cultural mythology that we believe in. And by mythology, I don't mean myth in the false sense. I mean myth in the real sense, the academic sense. A cultural's foundation stories and concepts. An example of a foundational story is the arrival of Columbus in San Salvador. That's one of the great legendary events, but it's a true event. An academic would regard that as a part of our mythology, our culture's mythology. Discovery of America for the Europeans by Christopher Columbus. In this sense, our religion, our Catholic religion, has a mythological dimension to it. The stories about St. Francis. But the point is, many of the stories about St. Francis are true. And we as Catholics are always very careful to employ the devil's advocate, to be skeptical, to be certain of what we believe as validity and actual fact. It's part of our strength as an institution. It is one of the not inconsiderable factors that has allowed the Catholic Church to last for so long. It's skeptical honesty about what it believes. But as I was saying, we fell out of love with ourselves and our country and our God. And we fell out of love by believing slander, such as the movie Bridge of Spies is. It's an uncomfortable accusation to make. But someone has to set the record straight. A proper understanding of the decades that preceded us, especially those that immediately preceded us, is important, is indispensable to live your life properly. It's an essential part of each one of our lives today, of the next moment you're living, to have a good understanding of what happened in the 1950s. So understanding the story of the 50s that lays behind the movie Bridge of Spies is important to know, because we should have a clear idea about what happened in the events of the 50s when we exchanged spies that we had captured and kept prisoner. We gave the Russians back their spy master of atomic secrets, Colonel Rudolf Abel. And they returned our downed U-2 reconnaissance pilot, Gary Powers. So it's important to reflect for a little time on the real story that the movie distorts. And then I wanted to look at a few other movie reviewers and to see if they were fooled by it or they were taken in by the presentation of those events. So we are going to listen to George McCartney's review of the movie in its entirety, as it tells the real story, not the politically correct, artful lie, the disinformative lie, which many people will now believe, having seen this powerfully made and beautifully made movie. But because the movie is directed by Steven Spielberg and has Tom Hanks starring in it, people are going to believe what's in the movie. And that's a real shame. Because it's a misrepresentation of real events. Just the kind of lie Stalin would want told to our youth. This may be a superbly crafted movie. But what about its content? What if the content is wrong? Disinforms. Teaches us that what we thought was good is bad and what we thought was bad is the good. Or confuses us on the issue. Well, that's the case this time. This is only one movie. It may be a great movie, but it's a tiny piece of our culture. But it is one more part of a great tidal wave, a huge tide of disinformation that we've been subjected to. You know, it can make one sad to know that some of these filmmakers and actors and writers who we admire so much for their genius and their skill are actually not the friends of virtue at all. In this case, the beloved Tom Hanks, the beloved Steven Spielberg, and the Coen brothers, those great writers whose movies I love so much, have descended to become nothing but propagandists for the defunct Soviet Union and its inhuman vision of man's future and where it was taking us. In other words, useful idiots. That's what Stalin called people like that. And I imagine we've all been useful idiots from time to time because we've been swept up in a great flood of disinformation about the great virtuous institutions of our culture and the virtues of our people. And whereas it is certainly true that the Soviet Union lost the Cold War and the United States won the Cold War, however, a large component of the Cold War, perhaps the largest component, was a culture war, a war of cultures. Let's tell the truth. Let's set the record straight. We lost the cultural war. People are not going to believe the real history, although it's amply documented by respectable historians. They're going to believe what they see in the movies, like the movie JFK, which as a whole told an untrue story, like the movie The Da Vinci Code, which also starred Tom Hanks, and falsely criticized the Catholic Church and told a false history, attesting that Christ had sired children by Mary Magdalene. You're probably wondering why I think the Soviet Union won when it seemed that they lost. It was like you had killed a venomous snake that had bitten you, but the venom was in your blood and later you died also. The Soviet Union conducted decades of a massive propaganda war, producing disinformation on every conceivable subject.
And injecting it into the arts, suppressing the true story, and amplifying and replacing the true story with a false story, the false version. This is Setting the Record Straight. Today we're straightening the record about a movie of Steven Spielberg's, The Bridge of Spies. The movie's been out for a few years, but I noticed some friends of mine are seeing it on Netflix or on DVDs. We'll be back in a few minutes.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We're back all together now after the break. This is Chuck Coughlin, Setting the Record Straight. About the broad consensus of establishment movie reviewers who praised the film Bridge of Spies, despite the fact that it tells a false story about a very important segment of our nation's history. And this was pointed out by one very knowledgeable reviewer, George McCartney of Chronicles Magazine, described as a movie that has an inverted morality because it distorts the real historical events so important to our country and important to the Catholic Church. There's a real connection here with the Catholic Church, because the reputation of our beloved church in the culture war of the last 100 years, the black legend that Britain told about the Catholic Church in respect of the Spanish Inquisition and the Crusades, is still with us today. Except in our time, it was the Soviet Union that was defaming the free world, the United States, and the Catholic Church. So this is the connection to our Catholic Church of this movie, The Bridge of Spies. An attempt to take down the Catholic Church was a massive project of the USSR, of their KGB. They wanted to take down our culture, and they did. And perhaps you don't think that they were the agent that did it. It would be more than the scope of this program would allow for me to fully describe why that is so. The aggressions of the culture war was a carefully enacted strategy. It was produced by a combination of disinformation, which originated in the USSR and the Soviet Republic and KGB, who employed tens of thousands of talented artists and professional spies. They did a very thorough job of defaming Pope Pius XII. I've heard the lies about Pope Pius XII repeated in the form of the confession of the honest truth about the faults of the Catholic Church in RCAI classes in Catholic churches only a year or two ago. The lies live on. They have a life of their own. The defamation of many of the most virtuous people of Christendom or in Catholicdom. And it wouldn't have had any legs at all if it wasn't for the useful idiots. That's us. It's our academics who still preach the virtues of the Soviet Republic. It still finds an expression in our media, especially in our music, in the despair so evident in rock music. One of my sayings to my friends is, our culture was destroyed by bad music. I think we need to go back to Palestrina and Mozart. Would that be succumbing to things that are old-fashioned? Obsolete? But Mozart and Palestrina represent a point way back in our journey through the woods of history, in which we took the wrong path. We chose the wrong path. Do we have to go all the way back to that path and take the other fork? Not necessarily, but we can build on the direction that it pointed to. We can cut across to it and still remain contemporary and bring forward those noble emotions which animate that music. But because they evoke nobility from the soul, music more powerful than any other art, far more powerful, evokes latent feelings within us, latent concepts even within us. It shapes and sculpts how we feel and think. Music sculpts the attitudes, the emotions of the young. And the young become the not so young, become the middle aged, become the grandparents. But most of the individuals in these generations are alive together now. They know each other. They're having Thanksgiving dinner together. But sadly, these last four generations will tell each other and tell those younger and older stories that had their origin in disinformation, carefully constructed disinformation. We teach each other viewpoints as we talk. And these politically correct viewpoints that I'm referring to that produced this movie, some of these had their origin in the Soviet's KGB. And the Soviet KGB knew they were lies, but they were useful lies. Stalin knew they were lies. He didn't believe them. We're the ones that believe them. We're the useful idiots. And his lust for attaining power, and that of Lenin and Trotsky and the rest of them, and of Mao Zedong, was so ardent that it became savage, was so passionate that it became inhuman. So what about some of the opinions of reviewers other than George McCartney of the movie Bridge of Spies? In the San Francisco Chronicle, Mick LaSalle said this, most movies about history are in some way about the times in which they were made. Bridge of Spies is not a direct allegory for our times, but rather a useful reminder that at all the pressure points of our history, there have always been people ready to do an end run around the Constitution out of either fear or convenience. Bridge of Spies tells us that the Constitution is not some quaint national luxury, but the roadmap out of the darkness. This all sounds very good, except those that ought to be depicted as villains in the stories are portrayed as heroes, and vice versa. The movie is about the turbulent geopolitical time that was the peak of the Cold War. Many people view that period as with pangs of nostalgia. In 1957, the globe was split down the middle with the threat of Soviet and American nuclear bombs hanging over every potential crisis in negotiation. Certainly, it kept the peace of MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, MAD. But there were moments of uncertainty, and one of these is the subject of Steven Spielberg's first movie in 3 years, The Bridge of Spies. The title refers to Bridge in East Berlin, which was frequently used as a site of prisoner swaps between the East and West. And the movie describes a real historical event. Tom Hanks plays James Donovan, a World War II veteran who settled into success as a prominent insurance lawyer. Though it's not exactly his realm of expertise, he's selected to defend an accused Soviet spy in order to demonstrate to the world that every man deserves a right to a fair trial in America. Defending a communist spy puts stress on Donovan and his family, but his service to his country is only just beginning. When the Soviets shoot down a U.S. spy plane and the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, falls into enemy hands, Donovan is sent on a secret mission to Berlin to negotiate Powers' release in exchange for his client. Just like Spielberg's earlier movie, Amistad and Lincoln, this movie features prominently the concepts in our Constitution. By one measure, around 98% of the critics praised this movie. Chris Nashawatki in Entertainment Weekly said, Hanks is in his comfort zone as Donovan, showing us a decent man grappling with history and his own civic ideals. But there's also a rascally twinkle in his eye that shows us that Donovan is more than just a red, white, and blue father and husband and in over his head. Part of him is getting off on the cloak and dagger rush of it all.
It's the actor's best performance at Saving Private Ryan. Critic after critic praises him. Chicago Sun-Times.
Listen to a little bit of the New York Times review.
Like some of Mr. Spielberg's other recent movies, this one is a meticulously detailed period piece that revisits the anxieties of the past while also speaking to those of the present. Yet it also feels lighter than those films, less weighted down by created history.
Or maybe by a sense of duty to its significance.
There's still stirring speeches and swells of important music. This is Steven Spielberg.
Yet for all the darkness, there still is laughter. So that was from the New York Times review of the film. Most of the rest of them on all the establishment critics. Follow that lead. These movie reviewers praise the writing,
the dramatic pacing, the acting,
and in general praise the great skill that has gone into the making of this movie.
Ann Hornaday in the Washington Post said that the movie seems carved from granite and mist, blues, grays, and chilly puffs of white light.
Artist Spielberg, what syrupy ambers are to Woody Allen.
Spielberg himself a child of the duck and cover 50s, adroitly establishes the heaviness and barely contained paranoia of the time, which he depicts with rich, unnostalgic atmosphere.
So that critic wrote, dissing the 50s again, so typical of our time, dissing the 50s.
It's interesting that people think of that time as a time in which we refrain from mutually assured destruction. And we imagine that the threat of a nuclear war is over, but it's not over. All sides, because there are more than two now, possess nuclear weapons and the way to deliver them.
If anything, our times are far more dangerous than the ridiculed duck-and-cover 50s.
To live as I have in all the decades since the 30s is to have witnessed a nation that has been turned aside from a correct path into a carefully constructed lie. The lie was so ingenious that it must have come from great minds. It did. It came from the vaunted intelligence of the Russian people. It came in the form of disinformation, of a lie that was so believable and seemed so true, so probable, that it would defeat the always improbable truth, because reality and truth are often not as believable as the clever lie.
Well, let's go right to the review by George McCartney, which sets the record straight about the misrepresented history in the movie Bridge of Spies, directed by Steven Spielberg. McCartney writes, Steven Spielberg's new movie, Bridge of Spies, recounts the Cold War spy swap that America made with the Soviet Union in 1962. We gave the Ruskies Adam's spy, Colonel Rudolph Abel, and they returned our downed U-2 reconnaissance pilot, Gary Powers. The film is beautiful to behold, filled with superior performances, and if taken at face value, seriously misleading. It lists so far left that you half expect to hear bilge pumps on the soundtrack. The film begins in 1957 with the arrival of Soviet spy Rudolph Abel, born William Fisher. Spielberg and his writers contrived to make a Fisher a wholly admirable martyr, a hero to the Soviet cause. They seem to forget that KGB sent him here to do grave damage to America. Beyond acquiring and sending atomic plans to his home country, Fisher was serving far vaster aims. His spy masters had gone so far as to imagine
that should the Soviet Union prevail in its war over its Western enemy, that he, one day, might have a hand in taking over the East Coast of the United States. Stick with us after the break, and we'll continue reading from the review by George McCartney of Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies. This is BreadboxMedia.com.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at BreadboxMedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
This is Setting the Record Straight on BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin. So we're going to continue with the review by George McCartney of the Spielberg's new film, The Bridge of Spies. Greatly praises the character
of an enemy of the United States who was intent on the destruction of probably of millions of American lives. Let's go back to McCartney's review. He writes, "The key to winning the war would, of course, be the atomic information Fisher was sending them. This meant that they were envisioning the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Americans. And why wouldn't they? Hadn't Stalin murdered 22 million of his own people before he shuffled off this mortal coil in 1952? Why shouldn't Americans contribute their might," he spells it M-I-T-E, meaning contribute our lives, "to the communist cause? This, then, is the man Spielberg and company think we should admire." To be fair, Spielberg has followed the lead of Fisher's court-appointed American defense attorney, James B. Donovan, played by Tom Hanks, who explains in his 1964 account of his involvement in the Fisher and Powers case, Strangers on a Bridge, that's the title of the book, that he came to admire Fisher's stoic resolve. Here, he marveled, was a man who was ready to face doom rather than cooperate with his American captors. There's no question that Fisher was brave. But what about his cause? He was committed to an ideology that openly professed a morality in which ends justifies means. He was wholly on board with Stalin's breaking of those millions of eggs to make his rancid communist omelet. Donovan, a conventional liberal, apparently was unable to make the relevant distinctions. Yes, Fisher was stalwart, well-educated, talented, and witty. But he also subscribed to a political philosophy that condoned murder when it served the expedience of the moment. Donovan never acknowledges this in his book, probably because, as a bon paysan, liberal, he never entertained the notion that a man of refined bearing and tastes, such as Fisher, could countenance murder as an instrument of politics. On such naivety, civilization's founder. Fisher was born and raised in England, where his revolutionary father had fled in 1903 in order to invade Tsarist persecution in the mother country. In the 1920s, his father brought him back to Russia, the better to enjoy the fruits of the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. The younger Fisher joined the army and later the KGB to serve the cause. He did so well as a radio technician practicing deception against the Nazis that the KGB sent him to America in 1948 to practice some more. Having established his cover identity as a photographer, he began to gather information from Soviet agents stationed in New Mexico and elsewhere about America's nuclear plans, which he dutifully transmitted to Moscow by means of his shortwave radio. And what of those Americans sworn to stymie such foreign skullduggery? According to Spielberg, the FBI and the CIA were to a man either bumbling fools or vicious bully boys. In an early scene, we see about 15 FBI agents sweatily galumph up the grimy stairs to Fisher's Brooklyn studio apartment, only to discover he's left ahead of them. Then they pursue him on the streets, where he effortlessly gives them the slip. When they later manage to corner him in the Manhattan hotel room where he conducts his espionage, he's able to outwit them once more. Under their very noses, he palms and destroys a quoted message. He's a veritable wonder at his dubious craft. But is this true? Not according to Donovan, who reports that only three agents went to arrest Fisher, and that they quickly foiled his attempt to destroy evidence. It seems Spielberg and his writers were so intent on portraying Fisher as a superior creature that they couldn't resist depicting the men who were doing all they could to protect our country as buffoons. In the subsequent trial, Donovan's legal defense of Fisher was not successful, but he did persuade the judge not to sentence him to death. Donovan argued that Fisher wasn't an American citizen, that he had been sent to our shore in the service of his country and should be regarded as a soldier and given the rights of an enemy combatant. Donovan clinched his argument by pointing out that Americans surely had agents in the Soviet Union. It followed that one day Fisher might prove far more valuable alive than dead. He could be exchanged should one of our spies be apprehended in Russia. 5 years later, Donovan's artful courtroom suggestion became a reality, with the capture of the American U-2 pilot, Garrett Powers. The second half of the film takes up Donovan's mission to East Germany, where he's sent to negotiate the exchange. Along the way, Donovan learns of an American doctoral student, Frederick Pryor, who's been arrested for being on the wrong side of the just-erected Berlin Wall and threatened with execution. When Donovan announces intention to include Pryor as part of the swap, a weasel-faced CIA agent tells him not to go all bleeding heart. The mission, this fellow insists, is to obtain Powers release. The kid's not to be part of the deal. As one would expect, Donovan indignantly refuses to comply. He's being played by Hanks, after all. This makes for an interesting plot turn, especially if you're unaware, as I was, that the CIA man and his warning were fabrications. The film's many departures from fact and the cause of ideological purity and ersatz excitement are, shall we say, unfortunate, including a wholly imaginary scene in which shots are fired into Donovan's living room by citizens irate that he's defending a commie. When it comes to the physical details of time and place, Spielberg has been scrupulous. For the scenes in the New York City subway that Donovan takes to his offices in Lower Manhattan, for instance, Spielberg acquired a 1950s rail car in which Hanks sits among everyday commuters, rocking placidly along to their everyday jobs. Why go to these lengths in verisimilitude if elsewhere you're going to invent things that never happened? As for the acting, Hanks gives another of his now patented everyman performances that have defined his later career. Here he's a quietly determined citizen doing his duty. We watch him in an earlier scene arguing his corporate client's case with an opposing attorney representing injured truck drivers. Donovan insists the individual suits be combined into one legal action. When his adversary plausibly avers this would go against fundamental insurance theory, Donovan smiles amiably, but digs in his heels. In the cause of reducing his client's costs, he's admirably adamantine. The iron fist in the velvet glove. This, as we shall learn, is the trait that will serve him well in the 11th hour negotiations he must enter into with East German and Soviet officials when they try to welch on their agreement to release both Powers and Pryor. Behind his smile and twinkling eyes, Donovan is shown to be as unyielding as a ferret. He reminds me of my Uncle James, a lawyer serving the interests of the Brooklyn Union Gas Company in the 1950s. He was one of those Roman Catholic Irishmen who, given the educational opportunity denied their parents, were then showing their mettle. A son of a waterfront dock worker, he had served in the Navy in the Pacific, and like Donovan, rose to be a commander in the Naval Reserve. He was tough, shrewd, and implacable in the pursuit of his company's goals. While Donovan was higher up on the class ladder than my uncle, he wasn't that far removed from his humbler origins and was well aware of the class issues that had preceded him and his kind. There's no doubt that these origins played their part in shaping these men. They knew how to play the game in which they found themselves. Playing the role of Fisher surely posed a more difficult challenge, but the British actor, Mark Rylance, is more than up to it. Using a perpetually downcast visage and unsmiling demeanor, he comes across as an entirely alienated man. When the FBI breaks into his room, he looks entirely unsurprised. They might be a passel of unloved relatives descending on him unexpectedly. He's willing to tolerate them, but only from a glum sense of duty. Rylance's Fisher is a professional's professional, disciplined, and unreadable. These performances enable you to see why Donovan admired Fisher. He had fallen under the spell of a champion dissimulator. After all, lawyers need to obscure their intentions in court. Should they know the man they're defending is guilty, they must nevertheless proceed as though he were not. What's not so easy to see is why Spielberg and his writers should also have come under this lawyerly mystique. You would think they would use their art to pierce Fisher's shell and uncover the deadly motivations within. But no, they allow themselves to be as misled as Donovan. They have bought into the Irishman's argument that Fisher was just a soldier on a mission, and further that America's panicked reaction to him was an example of the Red Scare hysteria inspired by the likes of Senator Joseph McCarthy. The film asks us to believe this in the face of the clear evidence to the contrary. Communism, judged on its intentions rather than its deeds, remains Hollywood's holy cause. After all, communists meant well, didn't they? Let's play a thought game. Imagine Fisher had been an idealistic Nazi, intent on establishing an offshoot of the Reich in America for our citizens' own good. Would he be given the admiring treatment the film accords the communist Fisher? Does snow fall on Rodeo Drive?
That last sentence is the last sentence in George McCartney's review. Does snow fall on Rodeo Drive? I wonder how you feel about this. After reflecting on these words of George McCartney's review of Spielberg's film, do you feel as intensely motivated as I do to go out there and set the record straight, to talk about this? To talk about how we have been enmeshed in a matrix of false information, of false politically correct information. Let's return after the break and talk a little more about this on BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin.
You are listening to BreadBox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at BreadboxMedia.com. BreadBox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
So earlier in the program, we've been examining the movie Bridge of Spies and critics' reaction to it, and the fact that most critics, practically all, didn't notice that it was representing, or rather misrepresenting, real historical events. In a way, very uncomplimentary to the United States. And in a way, very cold-hearted as to the well-being of the American people. One more example, one more specimen, establishing that there is a cultural war against the things that Catholicism represents. Certainly the United States, the best things about it, in many ways, are derived from Catholicism. Protestant Christianity also, but they are derived from Catholicism. Catholicism is really the mother of the best that is true about our country and inspired the most precious virtues of our people. So once we've examined and witnessed the viewpoint of Spielberg and Tom Hanks and the Coen brothers, the logical question that follows is, how did they get these opinions? Where did they come from? Why would they make a film like this? Well, there's a long story, and we were only in our last segment, but briefly I'll talk about it. Basically, these artists have succumbed to a myth about America, a negative myth, that is promoted by a number of subversive forces. And some of them occurring coincidentally, but the main thrust was discovered when the KGB archives were revealed and opened after the fall of the USSR and examined by scholars. And what was discovered was real documentary evidence of communist subversion. Subversion have been placing communist agents in American universities, American newspapers, like there were five at the Los Angeles Times, the reporter staff, paid communist agents. Some were academics, but some were high-placed officials in the U.S. government. High positions like Harry Dexter White, U.S. Secretary of Treasury under Roosevelt, and the Assistant Secretary of State, Alger Hiss, all well established as communist agents. Harry Dexter White was able to affect the outcome of the war in China, which led to Mao taking over the Chinese government. He couldn't have done it without the help of Harry Dexter White, who delayed funds that Roosevelt was trying to send to the opposition of Mao Zedong, Chiang Kai-shek. Roosevelt had ordered millions of dollars in a series of payments to be sent to Chiang Kai-shek. Harry Dexter White sent the payments, but through extensive delays prevented them from arriving in time to affect the outcome of the war, and we lost China to the communists. A subversive in our government or in our culture can have a powerful effect. We have a free society, and those freedoms are protected freedoms, and they protect subversives. And they can have powerful effects on the path of our government, and on our culture, and on our music, and on our movies. Deeply affected our negotiations with Russia at Yalta. What person do you think that Roosevelt took with him to Yalta? Only one assistant, Alger Hiss. And Roosevelt was weeks away from his death, in rather poor shape. And Stalin, to the great puzzlement of many observers of the Yalta Conference, Stalin was able to bargain with Roosevelt, bargain away the countries of Eastern Europe, who then became the captive nations behind the Iron Curtain and the captive peoples. And the Berlin Wall was later built to keep these people captive. But what about the archives? A story begins in 1943. A young German attending a communist international, that's called Comintern, school for foreign communists near Ufa, a city 750 miles east of Moscow, received an unusual assignment. The Comintern's archives had been transferred to Ufa when the Nazi army was threatening Moscow. And Leonard, his name was Wolfgang Leonard, was among a group of students given the task of putting the chaotic archives into order. His assignment was to organize the records of the American Communist Party. In his memoir written in 1958, a decade after his break with communism, Leonard noted and wrote about his first impressions of all these valuable documents in the archives. The Communist Party of the USA was readily conceded first place for chaos and confusion. Leonard wrote, "The sacks belonging to my American comrades contained not only whole bundles of party documents, which had simply been stuffed in without even a file cover being put around them, but also the remains of the cinema advertisements, old numbers of New York Times, broken pencils, and every kind of rubbish that had not the slightest connection with the archives. There were so many things that I would have liked to have read, protocols of sessions of the Central Committee, struggles with the factions, justifications for the expulsion of the leading party officials. But unfortunately, there was not the slightest possibility. I had to open the sacks, put the material in folders, and write on the outside, trade unions or miscellaneous, or party 1921 to 23, at a rapid pace. With every day that passed, though, we were urged more and more to pay less attention to accuracy than to speed." Unquote. Now, the Soviet Union never acknowledged possession of its archives, much less allowed scholars access to it. Until very recently, it was not known whether this valuable resource for the study of American communism had survived. Fortunately, these records do exist, and they form part of the vast Comintern collection, which is held by the Russian Center for the Preservation and Study of Documents of Recent History. 50 years after Wolfgang Leonhard sorted through these documents, the authors of a study that was published by Yale University Press, it comprised 20 volumes, had an opportunity to study these archives with quite a bit more care and attention to detail and understanding and correlation of facts. They presented their findings in those 20 volumes. Now I have three bookshelves devoted to the subject of communism and its subversion of the American culture. And I only have three volumes of this, 20 volumes. But occasionally I'm in a library and can peruse some of the others. We're talking about the record of almost a whole century. It's a vast subject. We're not really going to try to describe that. This material is essential to understanding of American communism and indeed the whole 20th century of American history. There's only a few minutes left, so I'm going to hit a few random points, a few highlights. In a future program, we'll return to more exhaustive studies of the very, very revealing contents of those archives. Few political organizations have excited as much controversy as the Communist Party of the United States, CPUSA. From its founding in 1919 until it subsided into just a mere trace and obscurity in the 1960s, the CPUSA was constantly in the news or in the minds of government officials. frequently involved in spectacular violent demonstrations, strikes, or other public events. It also was a continual target of local federal agencies. Some of the most important Supreme Court cases of the century dealing with fundamental issues of civil liberties arose from cases involving the CPUSA and American communists. From 47 until the mid-50s, no other problem was as contentious or aroused as much political disharmony as the issue of communism and communists. The newly declared Cold War was then in its most dangerous phase. Joseph Stalin ruled the USSR, and communism's influence was expanding in every continent. Most Americans regarded the fight against the CPUSA as simply the domestic front of a Cold War whose ultimate winner was undecided. Democrats and Republicans, Congress, and the executive branch, liberals and conservatives, all struggled to convince the nation that they were tougher on communism than their counterparts. The movement that aroused all this ire was inspired by the sudden violent seizure of the Russian government by the Bolshevik Party, led by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, in November of 1917. The triumph of Marxist socialism in Russia electrified radicals around the world, encouraged by the Bolshevik success. Marxist revolutionaries seized power in several European nations and made bold attempts to do so in others. In the political and social turmoil that followed the end of World War I, it seemed as though the Marxist millennium was near. Even in the United States, enthusiasm for the new regime swept through the ranks of the Socialist Party, then a small but lively presence in American politics. Hundreds of thousands of steelworkers went on strike led by communists. And in Seattle, a general strike led by a Bolshevik admirer shut down the city. Political terrorists detonated bombs, killing dozens and injuring hundreds in Seattle. Communists could soon be found in dozens of organizations dealing with every aspect of American life. Prominent writers, artists, and intellectuals flocked to communist-dominated groups such as the League of American Writers, the American League Against the War and Fascism, the American Youth Conference. That was a federation of the largest youth groups in the United States. And they were all communist-led. They were all communist-led. The American Communist Party raised large sums of money in Hollywood to support Marxist revolutions in other countries, in European countries. You can see that the communist influence set Hollywood on a course which it is still on. An understanding of this subject is indispensable to an American citizen. You know, there's a real need to set the record straight everywhere, not just in my insignificant program. But we need to live our life a little differently when we know the truth. We need to aim a little differently, because history provides foundation stones on which we walk into the future. And either they walk straight upon the truth or in a bent direction. That bent direction will carry over into the future. It becomes the future. It's very difficult to recover from an erroneous view of our past. It creates our future. It becomes our future. This is Setting the Record Straight, Chuck Coughlin.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.